presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are N. Scott James, Dennis Norden, Dillis Powell, and Frank Muir. Round one is a vocabulary test. 2 marks if you can give me the meaning of these words approximately correctly.
No problem.
I'll try. Dillis Powell, the meaning of the word, please, Dillis, spelt C-A-B-L-E-S-S.
C-A-B-L-E-S-S.
Yes?
That's what I am, and I can't get a cab.
Exactly right.
Don't add another syllable.
Cabless is without or unprovided with a cab for purposes of transportation. And that happens to Dennis on her way quite often. 2 marks. Dennis Norden, what does the verb mean to Google? G-O-O-G-L-E. To Google.
To Google?
Yeah.
Is it somewhere halfway between a gurgle and a gargle? In other words, is it an emitted sound?
No, or a goggle and an ogle? An emitted glance?
Yeah.
Yes, a glance might be the result. Think of sport.
A googly.
Googly. Mm-hmm. To perform a googly.
And would you like to have a shot at what performing a googly is?
Yes, it's a way of bowling a ball, in which, now in my day, it was all down to jumping up at the wicket, glaring at the chap, and twisting your fingers around the way that you never did twice the same way.
Yes.
And the purpose was to try and get an off break and a leg break.
Yes, that's
at
right.
the same time, but you never did. It just went clean over the bloke's head.
Well done. Very good, Dennis. That's 2 marks. It's a cricketing term, to bowl a googly, to bowl an off break ball with an apparent leg break action, which of course defeats the wretched batsman if you do it rightly, as Dennis says, you don't always do it. 2 marks.
And a Chinaman goes the other way.
A Chinaman is an off-break bowled by a left-handed bowler at a right-handed batsman. Now, Anne Scott James. Anne, what is a serpeach? S-U-R-P-E-A-C-H. Serpeach.
Something goes on top of something.
It does.
Custard.
I think it's face powder. It's something which goes over your peachy complexion.
I'll give you 1 out of 2. It's an ornament. Usually it was a jewel, the kind that you wore on the front and on the top of your turban. Serpeach. Frank Muir, what is Marowski or a Marowski?
In 1812, when the French forces under Napoleon had to retreat from Moscow in the rigors of a Russian winter, in the morning, that's what they woke up to, found themselves frozen to.
A nice thought.
Didn't they eat sort of Polish marrows?
No, I don't get, it is Polish, but I don't think marrows, that kind of marrow is going to help you.
The dance?
No, Frank, you did this rather well yourself. When you said she conks to stupor.
A spoonerism.
Yes.
A spoonerism is named after Dr. Spooner.
Yes, not necessarily only.
No, but presumably this is a Polish Dr. Spooner. Who also did the same kind of transferring the initial letters of words.
That's what I wanted. 1 out of 2. This is a... It was a deformed, invented language in which the initial consonants of words coming next to each other, contiguous words, are transposed. And as Frank quite rightly said, the Reverend W.A. Spooner was very famous for doing this, like Kinkering Kong's titles take. And Marowski is said to have come, I'm not absolutely certain about this, from a Polish Count Marow, or Marow. Before we begin the next round, I read out a quotation for each team to write down, and the 2 women members will, I hope, go on studying those quotations, because at the end of the programme, I shall ask them where the quotations come from. Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden, yours is, Our antagonist is our helper. And Dennis Powell and Frank Muir, yours is Deceits of the World, the Flesh, and the Devil. And then in the last round, I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their idea of how these came to be said or written. We come now to a round of misquotations. Now, some of the lines of poetry I'm going to read out are deliberately misquoted. 2 marks for correcting the quotation, and a bonus mark for saying where the quotation comes from. And notice, pal, tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night, aren't you worried that you might set the flipping trees alight?
Well, it's William Blake in the right order. Forest of the night. Something about thy awful symmetry, isn't it?
Yes, that's right.
What's something hand for all thy awful symmetry?
Yes, we're getting very close to it.
Tigers with a Y.
In the night.
Tiger spelt with a Y.
Yes, that's right. That's how they did it.
Yes, yes.
I think 2.5 out of the three. Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night, what immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? It's Blake the Tiger comes out of his Songs of Experience. Now, Dennis Norden. It is an ancient mariner, and he stoppeth one of three. The other two went walking on, the one he stopped was me.
It's The Ancient Mariner by Coleridge. And he had a grey beard and a glittering eye.
Yes.
Something about his grey beard describes him. And his grey beard and his glittering eye. And something about why stoppest thou me?
Good enough. That'll do. Just to get it quite straight for the record. It's an ancient mariner, and he stoppeth one of three by thy long grey beard and glittering eye. Now wherefore stops thou me? It's the opening lines of Coleridge's Ancient Mariner.
Samuel Butler said that he wonders whether this poem would really have had the immortality that it's had if it had been called The Old Sailor.
I think there's a lot in there. It's very archaic, words used all the way through.
You can't have your archaic and eat it too.
Now, Anne Scott James's turn. Anne, tell me not in mournful numbers life is but an empty dream. I prefer such dreamless slumbers. Nightmares almost make me scream. Oh, poet, have a shot at that.
Longfellow.
That's right.
It?
Yeah. I want it. Have a shot at the.
Oh, you do it. Go on,
then. I don't. Beyond Longfellow, Footsteps in the Sands of Time.
Yes, that's
right. I've got beyond that.
Well, give us an eighth for Mark and let it go.
Two, I think. That's all right. It goes like this. Tell me not in mournful numbers life is but an empty dream, for the soul is dead that slumbers, and things are not what they seem. Longfellow, Psalm of Life. Now, Frank Miller. I remember the house where I was born. It overlooked a bookstall where my daddy bought his form.
This is this unpleasant round where the compiler gets all the laughs.
Exactly.
And you just have to come in with a dull answer. It's that absolutely superb versifier, that English grand master of light verse, terrific satirist, very funny writer, Tom Hood.
Yes.
Early part of the 19th century. And it's a song called I Remember, one of these sad songs of lost innocence.
Yes.
And it goes, I remember the house where I was born, the little window where the sun came peeping in at dawn.
Absolutely right, except the last word.
Not a wink, morn.
Morn.
Not a wink too soon.
Good, well done, Frank. That's 3 marks. Thomas Hood. A round now of origins and derivations. For 2 marks, I want you to tell me how these words originated or were derived. Dennis Powell, flibbity gibbet.
It means somebody who's a bit sort of airy fairy.
Yes, yes, that's all right. But it comes from something rather different. Try King Lear.
King Lear? Oh, his fool?
Yes, the fool was plagued by the foul fiend, flibbity gibbet. Now, does that help you at all?
Well, the foul fiend to the Jew. It was a kind of foul fiend who lured one on, I think. Doesn't he? He lures one on in Lear.
Yes, he does.
Them on.
Well, there are quite a lot of them, but he one of five. one out of two, I think. But Flibbertigibbet was one of 40 fiends which were cast out by the Jesuits in the 16th century. And the Jesuits identified Flibbertigibbet as this kind of mischievous gossip that it's now become a frivolous, restless person. But he was one of the five fiends that possessed poor Tom, who was the supposed fool, Edgar and King Lear. And Flibbertigibbet was a nasty fiend, gave you squint eyes, hair lip, and pins and needles. One out of two. Dennis Norton, Balderdash.
Well, it means nonsense. It's a word you use to refute an assertion. It looks as though it comes from bal, which is French for a ball or carnival, de. And then we're left with dash. Well, that's all right. If you have French people, I have lots of. If you have the name like Jean-Pierre, it has a dash in the middle.
Yes.
So it could be that somebody called Jean-Pierre sent out an invitation to a ball, and they missed out his name on it and just printed the dash. Whoever received it, it was a nonsense. It was rubbish. It was.
Do you remember a word? All right, one or two. It does mean a jumbled mixture of ideas, nonsense, senseless talk. It can mean foul language. But originally it was the froth on the top of the tankard, froth on a liquid, or a mixture of things which ought never to be put together, like beer and milk. One or two. N. Scott James, tuxedo, and I mean an article of clothing.
Well, it is a dinner jacket.
Yes.
A man's rather sort of old-fashioned, stiff-shirted dinner jacket.
And how did it come so to be called?
Well, no, it's American in origin.
Yes.
There's a place called Tuxedo, wasn't there?
Yes, there was.
There's a place called Tuxedo Park, just near New York.
That's the one. There was a tuxedo club which lived at this place that Anna's described quite rightly, Tuxedo Park near New York. But a funny chap called Mr. Griswold Lorillard, in 1886, introduced for the first time a dinner jacket, which he'd brought from England. Up till that time, they'd all worn tails all the time, probably even while shooting, but I'm not certain about that. One and a half. Hank Muir, Sideburn.
Sideburn, by a curious inversion, came from a gentleman called Burnside.
Yes.
Who was, in fact, a rather inefficient American army general in the 19th century.
Yes.
But I think really what made it popular was he was a character, a funny character, wearing this curious beard in which the chin is naked and the hair forms a kind of H on the face with a huge moustache and the beard split in two and worn beneath the ears. Sort of mutton chop whiskers and a huge moustache.
I think, Frank, it does refer to the side whisker part of it rather than to the moustache in the middle, and therefore sideburns became side whiskers. Two marks. Well, now we come to the last round and go back to those two quotations I gave the teams earlier in the program. Two marks, and Scott James, can you give me the origin of yours, which was, "Our antagonist is our helper"?
No, I should think it might be Disraeli.
A little earlier. And a
political speaker.
Yeah, political speaker, political writer. In 18th century, definitely.
I should think it's Edmund Burke.
That's good enough. Two marks. Adelis Power, the origin of yours, deceits of the world, the flesh, and the devil.
Sounds to me like one of those things you renounce in the prayer book.
Mm-hmm. It comes from the litany in the Book of Common Prayer. Renounce all the deceits of the world, the flesh and the devil. Well, now I'm going to ask Dennis and Frank to give me their improbable explanations of how these quotations came into being. And for this round only, the marks will go to whichever unlikely story receives the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. So we go back to Dennis Norton and his phrase, "Our antagonist is our helper."
One day last summer, the lady who is, I think, my favourite aunt was sharing a taxi with two other ladies from her townswomen's guild, and when it drew up outside where they wanted to go, she looked at the meter, and then she said to the driver, "Oh dear, would you mind driving round another 5 pence worth? 3 into 40 doesn't go." Now, I was suddenly reminded of that incident the other day because I was trying to puzzle my way through a book called Lateral Thinking. And the author, Mr. De Bono, puts forward this theory that every problem today has become so complicated that it's no use trying to solve anything by using the old-fashioned straight line of reasoning from A to B, from point A to point B. What mankind has to learn to do now is to make mental jumps sideways to point C. No, neither could I. But while I was trying to work out exactly what a mental jump sideways was, I suddenly realized it's Auntie Aggie. Let me try and describe my Auntie Aggie. You'll be sitting with her in a very cozy sort of silence when suddenly she'll say, "I just cannot understand people who never keep brown paper in the house." Do you see what I mean? Her mind, her mind makes jumps. Mentally, she doesn't seem to need the same bridges that we need, particularly when it comes to anything that we, or the rest of mankind, regard as natural laws. There's a Met Office man called Bert Ford, for instance. Every time he appears on television, she says, "Oh, I like him. We always get better weather when he does it." Now, it's that kind of thinking that every now and again gives me this rather vague prickling at the back of my neck. Perhaps this aunt of mine, it just could be that, like the first fish that crawled out of the water onto dry land, my own Aunt Aggie is actually a link in the evolutionary chain. The first one whose mind moves only to point C. In other words, where that lateral thinking that Mr. De Bono is urging upon all of us is concerned, my family may have a distinct advantage because, as Edmund Burke very nearly put it, our Aunt Agnes is our helper.
Aunt Agnes is somebody we should all like to meet very much indeed, I think. We now go on to Frank Muir, and if you remember, his quotation was, "Deceits of the world, the flesh, and the devil."
An incredible number of listeners have written to me asking for a report on the progress of my Afghan puppy, Lady Offaline Mole. And I really mean an incredible number. Do you know how many letters I got? One. The letter was from an anonymous lady who signed herself Dog Lover, and she wondered whether calling my puppy Lady Otterline had produced an effect in the puppy, and said, "Has the puppy any sort of curious traits, any curious patterns of behaviour?" Well, I think it has, really. I think it's got sort of four items of behaviour worthy of interest. She loves a good book, but she chews any printed matter. And a couple of days ago, I'd got 4 very expensive seats for the new musical show about Queen Victoria. £2.50 a throw, that was, and there were 4 tickets in an envelope delivered by the postman, put on the table. 3 seconds later, little corner of an envelope left. No tickets, just the stamp and "Keep Britain Tidy." Lady Ottoline has a passion for leather, and only the other day she chewed round the edge of my shoe. And I went to a conference at the BBC, and at a particularly crucial moment, I crossed my leg, and my shoe opened, and little nails fall, and it looked like a dolphin reaching for a herring. Third, Ottie doesn't drink from her bowl. She never drinks water from her bowl. She drinks from the downstairs loo. Not only that, she's taught her mother to drink from the downstairs loo and her elderly poodle aunt. Now, I'm nothing against this. I mean, there it is. It's pure, clean water. But I do object to queuing up. And the other morning I came down and found her playing and chewing a rather largish green plastic ball. And I could hear the overflow going. And she chewed the ball cock off the downstairs loo. We had to switch it off, and now it won't flush. Point four. Cather Ottie. Ottie nibbles dangling things. And I've got an old duffel coat, which I wear when it's very cold. And she leaps up, and she doesn't sort of eat the thing. She just sinks her teeth in and sort of serrates it. So I've got a sort of deckle-edged duffel coat. So those are the 4 points that idiosyncratic points of my puppy, Ottie. Now, how does it range up with Lady Ottoline, after whom she was named? Lady Ottoline was an aristocratic patron of the arts in the early part of this century. Now, she befriended young literary men, and one of them she defended was Lytton Strachey. Now, Lytton Strachey was all against this great figure of Queen Victoria and the idea of the Victorian being a sort of grand monarchy against which no criticism should be levelled. And he rather sort of cut that away. And I think that the real Lady Ottoline would do what my Ottie did, and that was eat up very dear tickets to the performance of I and Albert, this musical comedy about Victoria. Point two. The other sort of people Lady Ottoline befriended were the Georgian poets like Walter de la Mare and the novelist D.H. Lawrence, who were all for the open life, and that they glorified the tramps who went along the road. And I think the real Lady Ottie would have approved of my Lady Ottie chewing off half the welt of my shoe so that the boot opened and I looked like a tramp. Point three, Lady Ottoline was an aristocrat, and aristocrats don't approve of downstairs loos. The gentry always, after dinner, retired cigarettes puffing and activated the compost heap. Point four, Lady Ottoline was noted for her eccentric dress ideas, and I think she would have loved the idea of me wearing a duffel coat with a lace skirt. So, anonymous dog lover, I think my Ottie does resemble the original Ottoline when you consider her diet for the last few days, which consisted of four items: deer seats, half the welt, the flush, and the duffel.
Well, by your vote, ladies and gentlemen, Dennis Norden wins the contest of the stories, but the other team, Ellis Powell and Frank Muir, win the entire contest. And that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland, with questions compiled by Peter Moore. The program was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason, and presented by the BBC.